Tonight, we are answering the top four money questions on your mind right now. You're listening to Simply Money, presented by Allworth Financial. I'm Amy Wagner, along with Steve Spravak. No, we are not mind readers, but we have been hearing from a lot of people this year who seem to have kind of the same set of issues that they want to talk to us about. So after talking, you know, across Allworth, all the advisors, right, all the questions that clients keep coming to us with, we're giving you the best of that knowledge, because we know if our people are thinking about it, you're probably thinking about it too.
Yeah, number one on everybody's list is, are stocks going to keep dropping? Yeah. I mean, this has
been
a rough year.
What the heck with the markets, right? Yes.
Yeah, this has been a rough year. I mean, the peak of the market pretty much was 2021. And beginning 2022, it's been like Chinese water torture. Every month, the down a little bit more, down a little bit more. Oh, July, fantastic. Oh, down in August. And, you know, September doesn't look like it's going to be that great either. So the question is, all right, at this pace, am I going to run out of money next year, the year after? You know, are they going to keep dropping? The answer is no. Stocks don't keep dropping down to zero. I mean, that wasn't a concern in 2008, and things were 100 times worse in 2008. This is called a bear market. They're common. They happen all the time. Doesn't mean they're fun, but a bear market is a drop of at least 20% among major stock indexes like the Standard & Poor's 500. You might feel like it's going to keep going down, 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 and the news seems to keep getting worse, worse, worse. But no, it doesn't happen that way.
Let's get some perspective here.
Yeah.
Positive years, far more common than down years. And how much more? Large cap stocks, right? So this is the S&P 500, 500 biggest companies in the U.S., produce positive calendar year returns 80% of the time over the past 50 years. 80% of years, markets are up. Not every year, of course, is going to end up, but 80% of the time, I'll take that.
Yeah, and they're cyclical. I mean, a couple things to keep in mind. First of all, markets go down earlier than you think they would have gone down because, you know, why are they going down when the news is still pretty good? Because there are smart people paid lots of money that kind of know what the most likely,
what's coming,
what the direction is. And it's the same on the swing up. You're going to see a bounce up from the bottom when the news is still pretty darn bad. And guess what? About 6, 7, 8 months later, the news is going to be really good. Wow. I guess some people knew that. Yeah. People work hard to try to predict trends in the economy. That's why they get paid the big bucks. And that's why, you know, the short version is, yeah, markets tend to move about 6 to 9 months ahead of the news. And so are we at the bottom? I don't know. I know we're down about 22% on the Standard & Poor's 500. Okay, that's usually somewhere pretty darn close to the bottom. Well, when are things going to go up? I don't know that either, but I know at some point the economy is going to come around and it's going to be better. And every day that passes is one day closer to that recovery. And when things recover, they recover for a lot longer than the downturn historically.
Yeah, you mentioned that recovery, right?
Yeah.
What happens over a 5-year period, right, following a 20% market drop like we have seen this year? The cumulative average return, close to 50% increase over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Back to the market timing, right? You know, when do you jump back in? The news will still be bad. And the markets, again,
right,
as your point, are looking far ahead. You can't know when the bottom is in order to be able to time things. And so we have seen person after person, research after research showing kind of the bad effects of trying to time the markets. And this is a point we've made this week, but it bears repeating. When you feel the worst about the market and the economy, those times are usually when the market has produced some of their highest returns.
Yeah.
When the American people, when we collectively are more worried about our 401ks and how much we're paying for groceries and all the things that we are all very worried about right now, that's usually when the market starts to rebound.
Yeah, and let's give some hard numbers, okay? Instead of just saying, don't worry, everything will be all right. If you look back to 1945, on average, when the market has dropped at least 20%, market being the Standard & Poor's 500, again, since 1945, on average, the market is up 1 year later, 14%, up 28% 3 years later. If the market drops even more to 25%, on average, it's up 21% 1 year later, 28% 3 years later. So when people say, okay, when is this going to recover? Is it going to be years, decades, what? Usually within a year after you hit 20% loss, and we've already hit 20% loss. Usually a year later, it's up 10, 14, 15%, something like that. That's why I don't worry. I know these things come back. We're batting 1,000 for them to come back.
You're listening to Simply Money Tonight here on 55 KRC. As we talk about the major money questions that are on your mind right now, of course, the first one, what's up with the market, right? Will stocks keep dropping? Another one that we keep hearing, and again, these are people coming into Allworth, right, asking these questions, a recession, right? Concern about a recession. Are we in one? Is one coming?
Yeah. And I think the closest, when you look historically, the closest to what we're going through right now is back around 1979, 1980. I mean, that's
as
when,
far as inflation and yeah, this kind of period during the Federal Reserve.
Paul Volcker just came on board as the chair of the Federal Reserve. I think it was in 79. Inflation was at 15%. You think we got a bad now? How about 15%? And a lot of people listening remember, oh, yeah, we had a mortgage that was 11, 12, 14%, yeah. Something like
ugly.
That. CDs were 12%. I wish we had those days. No, you don't, because you were going backwards at 12% because inflation was at 15. So when Volcker started raising rates, and he raised them about 4% in like 3 or 4 months. I mean, he said, enough's enough. We're going to get a handle on this. And it put us into a recession. That recession made stock prices drop 27%. That's not much more than we're down right now. Okay. That recession made stock prices drop 27%, and the recession lasted 20 months. You know how long the recovery lasted? Stock prices went up the next 5 years over 200%, about 230% for the next 5 years. So in other words, get through the recession, get through this 20-25% drop, and then boom. Historically, things bounce back, and they bounce back strong.
Isn't it funny? It's like when you're in a time like this, it feels like you're never going to get out of it. You're stuck in it forever, right?
Yeah.
Every day the headlines are worse. Every day you check the markets and they're bad. And then all of a sudden you're out of it. And you keep climbing, right? And we kind of forget what this kind of pain feels like. But in the middle of it, you know, not taking anything away from it, without a doubt, it does hurt. But it's a normal part of the cycle, and a part of the cycle that we will survive. Here's another interesting question. In this year, you know, I mean, it's normal to ask, markets down and are we going into a recession? But what's going on with bonds? Because the bond market has been acting in a way that this year that is not the way that it normally reacts. And I think there's a lot of people saying, what the heck is going on?
Yeah. I mean, even in 2008, when things were just completely falling apart, and I could not with a clear conscience and didn't say, oh, don't worry about it, things will be all right. Because in 2008, nobody was sure. At least bonds.
Everyone was worried.
Yeah. Bonds at least made 5% while your stocks were cratering. So, okay, they helped a little bit. Not so much this year. Bonds year to date, if you look at the AGG index, which is kind of what to bonds the S&P 500 index is to stocks, that's down about 13% year to date. Wait a second, I thought they were my shock absorber. Well, okay, they only lost half as much as stocks, but they're going down. Well, why? Because bonds go up and down based on interest rates. If interest rates go up, bonds lose money. Now, they come back eventually, and I had Andy Stout, our chief investment officer over at Allworth. I asked him to give me some statistics, and over the last 30 years, bonds have lost money 4 times, including this year, okay? The very next year, when the bond indexes lost money, the very next year, they made what they lost back and then some. I don't know if it'll be 4 in a row like that, but the track record is, yeah, at some point, the Fed will stop raising interest rates. Interest rates will stabilize, and they're going to start dropping interest rates to get the economy moving after the recession. When that happens, bond prices will go up. We'll see how long it takes for them to recover what they lost. But it doesn't mean they're going to keep going down forever. So if you understand why bonds went down, because interest rates were raised, and why bonds will go back up, because interest rates will stabilize and come back down, then you don't think it's a black hole and this money is gone.
You know, as we talk about the kind of top money questions that we're getting right now, the first three about the market, about the bond market, about recession, are more along the lines of explain this to me. But the fourth question that we keep getting is, what can I do? Right?
Yeah.
What should I be doing right now? It's a very natural reaction. You can't control anything else.
We're human.
What can you control?
Yeah.
And I think that's the biggest thing to focus on right now is control what you can control.
Yeah, and it's natural. I mean, okay, I see my account going down. I got to do something. And the hardest thing in the world is to do nothing when you see your account losing value. And it's not always the right decision, but it usually is. I mean, by the time the news is out, it's already too late. I mean, you've already seen the losses. So, you know, when you want to do something, usually what you want to do is I got to stop the blood loss. I got to just get out and get back in when the timing is better, when the dust settles, whatever you want to call it. And when you sell after a market loss, you just locked in your loss. You just eliminated your possibility of making that money back. Well, yeah, but I'll get back in when it goes up. When do you go back in? The biggest increases, the biggest moves in the market tend to be coming off bottom. And I'll tell you from 40 years of experience, that's usually when the news is the most negative, is when the stock market is at or near the bottom.
We talk all the time about the importance of having a financial plan, whether you're working with an advisor or you've put one together on your own. If you have a plan, and we would say it's incredibly important that you do, this is the time when you stick with it, right? Yeah. You see the wisdom of putting it together when there's not a storm going on, when the skies are calm, and then you stick with it when things are stormy. Here's the Allworth advice. Investors should prepare, right? Volatility is here, and it probably will be here for some time. On the other hand, history suggests that now could be a good time to invest if you've got some money on the sidelines. And if you can withstand possible short-term turbulence, you will enjoy long-term gains, right? We've seen it time and time again. Have you taken advantage of Costco's $1.50 hot dog deal? Well, it's back in the news. We're going to tell you why. And professional athletes throwing their money at a brand new sport. We've got those stories ahead. Plus, can you combine HSAs? We've got the answer to that and much more next. You're listening to Simply Money here on 55 KRC, the talk station. You're listening to Simply Money, presented by Allworth Financial. I'm Amy Wagner, along with Steve Sprovac. If you can't listen to our show every night, subscribe to our weekly podcast. It's the best of Simply Money on the iHeart app or wherever you get your podcasts. So how do you truly know if you have enough money in your emergency fund? We've got a refresher course coming up for you at 6:43. This is very, very important stuff. Speaking of important stuff, we're talking Costco's hot dog combo, their famous hot dog and soda combo, $1.50.
$1.50.
Amazing. Everything else costs more these days, not your hot dog.
All right, let me ask you this. You got like 18 kids now or something, right?
We have four.
When you guys go out, I'm not talking about, you know, fancy schmancy five-star place, but just a regular, you know, a regular restaurant with your family. What's a bill? I mean, with all the kids, the whole family.
Yeah, so when we say no soft drinks, right,
yeah.
just waters and what you're going to eat.
You do that to your kids.
Oh, I totally do.
Okay.
I totally do. Sprovac, do you know how much they charge for soft drinks nowadays?
Yes.
It's like $3 each. So that's another $12 on the bill for them to get. And you know what? They only drink half of it. And then they ask for water later anyway. So I'm just getting, anyway, off of my rants on how much soft drinks are, at least $50.
Yeah.
At least $50.
You got to start going to Costco. $1.50 each. How many kids?
Seriously.
Yeah,
I know.
$1.50.
We can all
one
eat
hot dog
for
kids,
less
sorry.
Than.
And you get to have pop. I'll let you have your pop.
There you go. So Costco's always been known for this. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that they're keeping it at this price. But the CFO has recently gone so far as to say this will be the price of the hot dog and the Coke at Costco forever and ever and ever and ever.
This must be like a really big deal to him because he was asked the same question like two, 3 weeks ago, and he dropped an F-bomb.
Yes.
And he said, "I this is going to stay this way as long as I'm F-bomb alive."
Yes.
You know, he's serious. He loves his hot dogs and pop, apparently.
So I dragged one of my teenagers to Costco with me earlier this week. And
treating you to dinner. Here we go.
Right? It wasn't even saying I'll treat you to dinner, but we got through and we had, of course, just eaten. And like teenagers, I just fed them and they're hungry again. And normally I would say, I just fed you. But it was a $1.99 pizza and a 69-cent soft drink. And I was like, absolutely, go for it.
Knock yourself out.
Exactly.
The sky's the limit.
Good what they you. Know, of course, is this is a marketing ploy, right?
It's to get you in the door.
They get you in the door.
Yep.
You're going to pay more for other things. If someone walks into Costco and only buys a hot dog, right, you are pretty much alone in that. They know you're going to come in and buy other things.
Buy a pallet of toilet paper or something that you don't need for the next 3 years.
Yep. First time, no joke, first time they were making fun of me this morning, our producers, because I resisted Costco for a long time.
Yeah.
First time I went in, I spent $400 on stuff that ultimately, like, maybe we used half of it. It's so overwhelming. You have to kind of figure out what the right system is for your family. I think we've finally gotten there. Pickleball is a big deal these days. Have you played it, Steve?
I have not, and I refuse to. I am a tennis snob. My wife played tennis in college, and we went to a tennis shop, and it was funny. Walked in, and we need some equipment. And the lady looked at us and said, "You're not some of those pickleball people, are you?"
All right, well, I am, because I'm not a snob of any sport, because I haven't mastered a single sport. They actually put a couple pickleball courts into our neighborhood, and so my son and I love going up there. I don't know exactly the rules, but we're learning them. But turns out there's a lot of major athletes. We're talking billionaire athletes who are kind of jumping on this pickleball train. LeBron James, right, and his business partner are going to join ownership ranks. They're buying a pickleball team.
You know, they're always looking for different ways to invest their money, because they got more money than they know what to do with. And you know, this is something I'm frankly kind of shocked at the way it's kind of taken over the industry. And it confuses me. I don't get it. Maybe because I haven't played, and there are a lot of people saying you should try it. It's a lot of fun. Whatever. And as long as you enjoy yourself, good. But it is a trend. I was thinking of jumping on the cornhole bandwagon and dominating that industry, because that's kind of my pocketbook.
Too late.
Yeah. What are you going to do? But they're serious about it. And LeBron and his business partner, Maverick Carter, they're getting together with some other NBA players.
Yeah.
And they're taking over the industry. They're trying to invest a whole lot of money in it.
They see that that's where it's going, because I'm playing it now, so everyone must be playing it. I'll tell you one thing about the rules. There's a part of the court called the kitchen, and you can't stand in the kitchen, and that's all I know. All I know at this point. Exactly. It's too hot in the kitchen. Every Sunday, you can find our All Worth Advice column in the Cincinnati Inquirer, and of course on Cincinnati.com. Every week, though, we give you a sneak peek right here on the show. First question comes from FD, who lives in Winton Woods. I have two HSAs. Can I combine them?
Listening to you. Must have, because that's your favorite. Yeah, he wants to know, can I combine two HSAs?
And health savings accounts?
Yeah, and the answer is, yeah, you can. And it's treated kind of like an IRA rollover. You can, if you have two different IRAs, you can combine them. You can do it in one of two ways. You can either take possession of the money for less than 60 days and put it in the other. You're allowed to do that once. Or transfer directly from one directly to the other. That's called a transfer. Same thing with health savings accounts. You can do one rollover a year where you physically take possession, or, and this is usually what you want to do, just have the one HSA have that money sent directly to the new HSA. And you know what? A lot of people have health savings accounts, Amy, that aren't invested. They're just at the bank earning minimal interest. And there are good investment accounts that are HSAs. So it might make sense to get into the higher performing one.
I think the stat is like there's less than 10% of people, right, who can use an HSA, who have them, who can invest that money, who are not. So if this makes sense for you, please, please take advantage of that. And just understand, too, this is a good way to keep organized, right? You've got all these HSAs out there, all these 401ks. It's too much. So I think this can make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Next question comes from KL and RL, who live in Kenton County. Our daughter going to be starting college in early 2023. Do we need to buy any kind of insurance policy for her? We're just thinking all about all that could happen in a dorm. So funny thing, we've got a kiddo going off to college next year.
Okay.
I read this question when it came in and thought, oh, my gosh, I didn't think about this.
Yeah.
I mean, you had two boys that went away to college. Did you change anything about your insurance?
No. Well, we made sure they were covered, under our policy. And some policies cover, some don't. I just wish there were insurance for bad decisions, because I could have used that when I was in college.
Couldn't we all, though? Come on.
Well, go ahead. Spill.
I'm gonna spill this. If your child is in a dorm, right, there is actually dorm insurance coverage. Start with your own policy first. See what off-premises coverage that you have, because they very likely could be covered there. Most kids live in a dorm, I don't know, freshman, maybe sophomore year, and then they get a house or an apartment with others. This is where renter's insurance needs to be a serious consideration. It's super affordable, usually just over $100. Anything could happen. happen, as we all know, in the college environment, and making sure that if something happens or some kind of fire, something like that, that their stuff can be replaced, that you've got that money. So definitely something to think about. Coming up next, we're looking at auto insurance and the true cost of it. You're listening to Simply Money here on 55 KRSD, the talk station. You're listening to Simply Money. I'm Amy Wagner. You know, making sense of your car insurance, how much you pay, depends on so many factors: where you live, your credit score, what you drive, your driving history. Helping us to try to make sense of all of this tonight is Sarah Foster. She's joining us from Bankrate. She's an analyst there. Sarah, it is kind of hard to make heads or tails of it, especially right now during this time of crazy inflation. We're paying more for everything. How do we figure out if what we're paying is a good deal?
Yeah. Well, this is a very important question, and thank you so much for having me, Amy. I think obviously inflation is impacting virtually every kind of aspect of the driving experience, mm-hmm. whether you're filling up your car with gasoline, or maybe you're in the market for a new or a used vehicle. And now we know that auto insurance is really also front and center with inflation. And so what we found is that nationally, drivers spend a little more than $1,700 a year on their car insurance. That's about 2.57% of their household income. Mm-hmm. But in order to make sure that you're getting the best deal possible, it's really important to shop around. And so every different premium that you'll see can differ depending on who you have auto insurance with, what your driving experience, what your driving history is like. There's so many factors, and I think thankfully, you know, if you spend any time watching TV, I think I have a Hulu subscription, and pretty much every other advertisement that I get is from a different car insurance agency. So what that shows is that there are thankfully options, and it's really important to take them all into consideration, especially when inflation is at a near 40-year high.
Yes. And Sarah, you know, there's some things that you can't control. I mean, when you look at your car insurance premiums, some of that is determined by where you live, right? I'm looking at the map that's broken down by Bankrate. Looks like Ohio and Indiana are 14th and 15th out of 50 as far as the cost. Kentucky, I live across the river in Kentucky, we're 45th. No one's going to move, of course, because of how much they're paying for auto insurance. But there are some other factors that we can control.
So what we really saw is that high cost states are really some of those culprits for being the most expensive for drivers. We saw, for instance, that Florida was the second most expensive state where drivers are spending a little more than $2,700 a year mm-hmm. on their car insurance. We also saw that New York was the third most expensive. We know that inflation really impacts those residents' experiences. But what's also really interesting is that how much per capita each kind of resident makes in an area also depends. And so if you're spending a little bit more on your car insurance, but you also make a little bit more income, that percentage of income that's spent annually on car insurance, which really matters, obviously, for our budgets, ultimately gets to be a little lower. And so I think that's why you saw states, for instance, like Hawaii, Maine, Massachusetts, for instance, Boston, that's a very expensive city. It was also, however, it was the least expensive metro area for car insurance. I think that's one of the main reasons that you saw it get to be pretty, at least a little bit more affordable based on the income that drivers make. But obviously, this is just kind of one factor here. Car insurance companies are juggling a wide variety of, you know, cost claims, also the risk of driving in a state. Obviously, there are so many different factors that car insurance use to weigh, and all of them are kind of having their own little proprietary algorithms that they use, which could ultimately make it, you know, less expensive for you to have a car insurance policy from one company to another.
You're listening to Simply Money tonight here on 55 KRC. We are joined by Sarah Foster. She's an analyst from Bankrate, breaking down how it's determined what you pay for your auto insurance, where you live, right, being one of those. You're probably not going to move to get cheaper car insurance, but things like your credit score, things like the vehicle that you're driving do make a difference. Sarah, let's talk about the things that we can control here.
Yeah, so we also notice here that life events are a big they greatly impact how much we spend on car insurance.
We have three teenage girls in our home, Sarah, three of them. two are 16, one is 14, going to be 15. When you talk about life events, I'm going to guess that's the mother of them all as the most expensive.
Yeah, so nationally we saw that if you're adding a teenager to your policy, it's going to cost you an extra $2,000 a year on average.
Yikes.
Again, it depends on where you live, but this is a very costly expense. In fact, it was more expensive than the cost of if you were, for instance, in a car accident, or if you had a speeding ticket, or even if you were convicted of a DUI. Adding a teenager to your policy is the most expensive life event.
So as we talk about, right, what you can control, these life events, of course, you can't control that your kid's turning 16, but what you drive and your credit score also part of that.
Yeah. So the credit score, that's a big one. And obviously that focusing on at least maintaining a strong credit score can make a difference in kind of the overall rate that you're charged, at least when you renew your policy or potentially shop around for a new rate. But it's also kind of a difference here of how every other state kind of has different rules that they use to enforce what kind of data that insurance companies can use to calculate your individual car insurance rate. But overall, we saw that on average, if your credit score decreases from good to poor, that's going to cost you an extra $1,200 a year. It's also really interesting here to look at speeding tickets, $367 extra dollars a year. Getting involved in a car accident, $750 extra a year on average. Again, I mean, emergencies do happen, and we can't, you know, underscore that that's really the reason why we have car insurance. But concentrating on being a safe driver and thinking twice, you know, about what kind of car that you do have on your car insurance policy, especially if you're adding a teenager, that can make a big difference in how the insurance company assesses your individual risk and then ultimately calculates your premium.
Sarah Foster joining us from Bankrate tonight, making sense of your auto insurance rate. Sarah, you say it makes sense to shop around, but how often do you recommend that and where do we start?
Yeah, well, I think it's first most important to just take a look at your own individual policy because you have to have a starting point. Make sure you know when your renewal date is, maybe ask questions with an insurance agent if you're trying to understand what's in your policy coverage. I mean, perhaps maybe you're driving an older car that might not make sense to take out the fullest coverage possible on it because if you do total your vehicle, the insurance company most of the time is only going to replace, you know, up to the cash value of that car. Mm-hmm. So it really makes sense to understand what you're starting with. And then it's a wise idea to just go around and look at other companies and kind of plug in quotes. Most of the time, these quotes will last for 30 days. And for most of us, our insurance renews once a year. So if you're coming up on maybe you say a month away from your policy renewal date, that's a really good time to make sure that the rate that you are going to get by staying with your insurance company is at least competitive compared to the market rate.
Absolutely. Sarah Foster joining us from Bankrate with just some great insights, right? You're paying more for everything now. Don't pay more for your auto insurance than you have to pay. It makes sense to shop around to get the best deal that you possibly can. You've been listening to Simply Money here on 55KRC, the talk station. You're listening to Simply Money. I'm Amy Wagner along with Steve Srovac. Straight ahead, the results of a survey about buy now, pay later plans, not surprising at all to us. The latest information, though, you probably want to know about. All right, this is something so basic, yet it is critically important. Steve, how many times have we had, you know, someone come into the office and I've got this in my 401k and
yeah,
I've got this saved and I've got that and I've got insurance and they just feel like, oh, I've got everything covered.
Yeah.
And you ask the question, but do you have an emergency fund?
Exactly. You know, and generally they're grinning and, you know, I don't know why I even need you. I've done this. I've got it all figured out.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I need an advisor because here's what I have. And I look at their assets and their statements and, wow, are they efficient? They've done a great job of saving plenty of money to be able to retire. And savings account, $6,000, which maybe while you're working is okay. But when you're retired, an emergency fund of 3 to 6 months, boy, is it important. And I'll tell you what, if you haven't done it, if you haven't built up a decent emergency fund and you're ready to retire next month, I'm not sure you're going to be able to get it done once you retire. So let's talk about it.
It's funny, when I first got married, when I was in my 20s, the emergency fund, the entire savings account was $600.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it was. Once the bills were paid, that was what was left in there. And I remember being not comfortable at all. Like,
right. If
something happens, like, we're in a world of hurt. We got lucky during that time, and then we started to kind of prioritize this. We would say 3 to 6 months, I would say closer to six, maybe even higher, of critical expenses is what you have to have set aside. But I think it's also kind of, there's the sleep factor to it. I know someone who, during the Great Recession, he had a great job. His wife is an engineer. She had a great job. Within a couple of months of each other, both of them lost their jobs.
Yeah.
Three kids at home. Now he has a full year's worth of expenses set aside. It's not invested in the stock market.
Right.
It is liquid. But he did that because they learned the hard way. Hey, we don't ever want to feel this way again.
Yeah.
And so we're going to have the money set aside so we don't have to.
And a lot of people say, well, yeah, but wait a second. I'm not getting any kind of interest. I mean, I've got all this money set aside. It's not doing anything. No, it's not doing anything, which means it's not going down either. And when the market or your investment accounts are going down, yeah, it's kind of nice to know that that money is rock solid safe. I'll tell you an example, real life example. People I've been dealing with for almost 20 years. They're retired. Both husband and wife are retiring this year, and they've been doing everything they need to do. When they first came to me, typical example, great investors, but no emergency fund. Well, now that they're getting closer to retirement, I've asked them to increase their emergency fund. And their first question was, yeah, but why? The reason is, if you've got $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 sitting in a money market, sitting in savings when you're retired, guess what? When you start drawing a couple thousand dollars off of your investments, like a lot of people do in retirement, and the market goes down, you don't have to pull it out of investments that are down. You can pull it out of that emergency fund. You still need the money to pay the bills and go on trips. Why let this impact your lifestyle if you've got the savings, if you've
got
the emergency
fund? You're not locking in the loss, right?
Exactly. And, well, wait a second. That brings my emergency fund down to an uncomfortable level. Yeah, but when your investments go back up, and they will, they always have, they always will, you replenish the emergency fund with the investment accounts that have since rebounded. It gives you a fantastic tool so that you don't have to change your lifestyle, but you're not drawing down investments when they're down.
And I think we would say, hey, any money that you don't need or that you are going to need in the next 3 years isn't in the market anyway, right?
Yeah.
If you have a wedding coming up, a kid going away to college, a major medical expense on the horizon, you pull that money anyway. And the thing is, because what's your option if you don't have that money set aside?
Right.
Yes, you pull from your accounts. If you're not, 55 yet, if you're not 65 yet, or you can't, 59 and a half, I guess, would be the cutoff for some of your retirement accounts. Well, then you're paying penalties on that money.
Right.
Or worse, you're putting it on your credit card. And now all of a sudden, that money that you worried about not making anything, it's costing you what the annual percentage rate on a credit card right now, 17.5%, 20%, getting close to that. So this is crucial. And we would say, hey, when you're building a financial plan, this is the foundation.
Yeah. So how do you do it? Okay, you've acknowledged you need a bigger emergency fund. Well, start off with tracking your spending. I'm not going to use the B word. We're not going to use that budget.
Not the budget.
I'm sorry I said it. But no, track your spending and see where the waste is. Not cutting back on your lifestyle, but, maybe you've got three or four different subscriptions on Netflix and whatever, and you don't use half of them. So just track your spending, know where it goes, and figure out how much should be left over at the end of the month. Track your spending, track your income, set aside money for miscellaneous. Don't penny pinch to the nth degree. This is something you need to do to put together a retirement plan anyway, and figure out, okay, I should have $300. I should have $400. I should have $50 left over at the end of the month, and shift that into your emergency fund. Make a plan, set a goal of what you want to build that fund to, and then keep to it. If you can do that and get there, especially by the time you're retired, your life has totally changed. Your stress level has gone down dramatically.
I would say direct deposit too, right?
Yeah.
Figure out how much you want to start setting aside. And listen, we're saying the goal should be maybe 6-9 months of critical expenses, but obviously you're not going to start there, but you start building toward that. And I think direct deposit is a way that, hey, you don't even see that money. It's not there.
Yeah.
It goes directly into that account. But over time, you're looking at that emergency fund and you're sleeping better at night. There's peace of mind there that not... if something comes up, but when it comes up, you can tackle it. Here's a Simply Money point. The emergency fund is an anchor that's going to keep you from sinking when an unexpected storm hits. And of course, at that point, you're taking on water. Next, buy now, pay later, the recipe for disaster. We're going to get into that. You're listening to Simply Money here on 55KRC, the talk station. You're listening to Simply Money. I'm Amy Wagner along with Steve Sprovac. Steve, this has become all the rage with anyone who is shopping online now. We're talking about these buy now, pay later plans.
Yeah.
It's the kind of the opposite of the old school layaway where you used to pay the installments and then get the thing at the end of paying them off. Now you get the thing up front, but you're paying it off for a while. And interestingly, now that this has been popular for a while, we're starting to get some data in that maybe this isn't working out so well for everyone.
Shocker. Shocker.
Surprising.
The instant gratification plan. Let's rename it. You know,
yes.
it's and you've been on Amazon. I've been on Amazon. You will see things that are you know, 50, 100, 150 bucks that, well, okay, you can pay this off over six installments, you know, and as you and I have predicted, this is causing some people that aren't paying attention and just say, hey, I want that. I'll do the buy now, pay later option. And you forget you did it and people are getting in trouble over it.
30% of those in a recent survey said, hey, because of this buy now, pay later, I have struggled to make that payment and have then therefore skipped paying a bill for an essential. We're talking about utilities,
yeah.
Your mortgage,
yeah.
Your car, childcare, right, to avoid defaulting on that buy now, pay later program.
Yeah, and you know, this is, I'm not surprised at all, are you?
No.
I mean, you know, bad decision, Amy, 23-year-old Amy.
Yes.
Would you have done this?
Oh, I would have been
over
this in my early 20s. Because
yeah.
There were so many things that I wanted at that time, and I had this absolutely measly paycheck that couldn't cover anything.
Right.
But if I could get online and see that those jeans that I really wanted or those shoes or, hey, that new couch that I think I would really like is only $100 if I pay it off in these installments, I would be all over it. And I think that the problem for a lot of people is what I would have done when I was 23. You're buying more than one thing.
Yeah, exactly.
On these pay later
plans. And if you don't track it, you're going to lose track. I mean,
that's
all there is to it. So all of a sudden, you know, you bought this, that, and the other thing, and you know, they're not real meaningful. They weren't needs. They were kind of wants, and worse yet, they were compulsive wants.
Impulsive,
well, for me, it's compulsive. But anyway, I'm the guy that stuff at the checkout lane of the grocery store was set out there for. I don't care what it costs. I need that candy bar.
Impulsive buy. Right?
Bingo.
Is that what it is?
Bingo. But, you know, all of a sudden you find yourself mired in debt and, you know, they're not going to come to your house and take it away and say, okay, forget about paying. You owe that money. That's all there is to it. That's one of the big differences between the old rent-to-own programs. Remember them?
Yeah.
And they're still around. You can furnish a house. You can get a TV. There's actually rent-to-home homes where the rent that you pay goes towards ownership of that. There's lots of programs, but they all have consequences, and that's the problem here. They're not going to come in your house and take away that TV that you bought on buy now, pay later. And people are getting in trouble, and unless you start tracking this stuff, it's only going to get worse.
Well, and more than half the people in this survey who had purchased one item on buy now, pay later had purchased multiple. And
yeah.
That's kind
yeah.
of the that's the sinking sand that we're worried that people were going to get into. And the interesting thing is when they looked closely at how much people were spending, well, it was anywhere between $50 to $5,000. But the average for these purchases, between $100 and $200.
That's the big concern. I mean, these are just impulsive purchases. And you know what? If the industry is growing by 40%, which is a big number, and that's what it's growing by, it's not going away tomorrow. This is a big profit center for these retailers. They're going to keep doing it.
Nearly half the people, right, had already done this. But here's the interesting thing, and this is a statistic I think that we want to leave you with tonight. 1 in 5 of the people in this survey who had bought something now, paid later, regret it ultimately.
Sure.
Right? They wish that they hadn't, whether it was an impulse buy they couldn't afford, whether now it's affecting their ability to pay other things. It can just be a slippery slope. So just make sure your kids, right, understand this, that they understand, hey, don't buy something you truly can't afford. That's what it all comes down to. You've been listening to Simply Money tonight here on 55KRC, the talk station.